I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia School Reform Commissioner Bill Green is suing Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, who removed Green as chair of the SRC last winter. WHYY senior education reporter Kevin McCrory is here to break it down. Welcome, Kevin.
Good to be here, Dave.
So Green chaired the commission. Wolf demoted Green to commissioner, and now Green wants his chairmanship job back. Review what brought us to this point.
Okay, so Green was appointed by former Governor Tom Corbett to the chair of the SRC in January 2014. He left city council to take that gig, and that's an unpaid gig. Served in that role for about a year. Come February 2015, with Wolf in office, Green was demoted following an SRC meeting where five new charter schools were approved. Wolf had been lobbying SRC members against approving any new charters, claiming they would add unsustainable costs to the already cash-strapped district. Green and other commissioners argued that, hey, the state charter law does not allow decisions to be based on fiscal impact. So they said, quote, "We're calling things by the balls and strikes on the merits of the applications."
And that's when he was demoted by the governor.
Right. And then Wolf promoted Commissioner Marge Neff, a longtime district principal and former teachers union member who has been a consistent no vote on charter schools, to the chairmanship. Green then contemplated legal action, but decided against it. Here's what he said at a press conference with Neff shortly after that all happened last year.
"It would have created a continuing partisan issue in Harrisburg. And frankly, that is not in children's interest, not just in Philadelphia, but across the Commonwealth."
So frankly, what's changed?
So Green says that he's continued to think of himself as chair for the past year, and that the historically drawn-out budget fight in Harrisburg influenced his decision. Essentially, he says he doesn't believe things can get any more partisan. So here was his logic today.
"Essentially, I don't believe at this point it's going to be a distraction. The battle lines are fairly hardly drawn in Harrisburg."
Well, beyond belief, what does the law actually say?
So the law says SRC members can't be removed from office unless there's evidence of wrongdoing. And it really all comes down to the word office. Wolf argues that the law gives him the power to demote someone from the chair position and keep them in the office of the SRC. Green argues that the chair itself is an office that should be insulated from political meddling. So now it will be up to the Commonwealth Court to hash out that distinction.
Kevin, next up, help give us a sense of the broader implications.
Okay, so Green believes that Republican lawmakers in Harrisburg will be more willing to direct funds to Philadelphia with him at the helm instead of Neff. If the courts displace Neff, advocates for traditional public schools would certainly mourn the action. The chair really gets to set an agenda and demands a higher level of responsiveness from district leaders. And Neff has put district schools at the center of that agenda, where Green is more agnostic about whether they're charter or district. But don't forget, no matter who's the chair, all five SRC members still have the same amount of votes, one each. Really getting down to brass tacks, though, if the court rules in Green's favor, he would stay the chair until 2019. If the court rebukes him, Neff's term ends in January, and Wolf would get to appoint a replacement chair.
So with that, what are we hearing from Neff and Superintendent Height?
Neff says, hey, it's for the courts to decide, and she says she's not going to let it affect day-to-day operations. Superintendent William Height, who often criticizes debates about governance as distractions, is remaining markedly silent.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY senior education reporter Kevin McCrory on NewsWorks Tonight. In other news this evening, the Pennsylvania primary is just 1 week out, and while presidential fireworks dominate the news, there's a hotly contested race among three Democrats who want to be the party's U.S. Senate nominee. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that the National Party has weighed in with big endorsements and big money to try to pick the winner.
Retired Navy Admiral and former Congressman Joe Sestak got a warm reception when he spoke to a gathering of the African-American sorority Alpha Kappa Alpha over the weekend.
"I then ran for Congress for one reason, to pay back my country. I was an independent, became a Democrat, ran in a Republican district, almost 2-1.
Sestak ran and nearly won the Senate seat 6 years ago. He's a tireless campaigner who connects with audiences, and he's led in every poll so far. But you won't find him standing next to Democratic Party leaders. They're all backing Katie McGinty, the former Pennsylvania environmental secretary who ran for governor 2 years ago.
"And your dear friend, and the next senator from Pennsylvania, Katie McGinty."
McGinty met with public employee union members this week to get the endorsement of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. She talked about her own parents.
I know for sure that but for Social Security and Medicare, my parents would not have had dignity in their retirement.
McGinty has accused SESTAC of favoring cuts in Social Security benefits. He points to dozens of votes cast defending the program, and fact-checkers say McGinty has exaggerated SESTAC's comments about past efforts to restore the fiscal health of entitlement programs. On most policy issues, there's not a lot of difference between these two candidates. They both want to raise the minimum wage, fight climate change, protect marriage equality, and expand health care. The third candidate in the race, John Fetterman, the 6'8" mayor of the tiny town of Braddock, Pennsylvania, says he has on-the-ground experience fighting injustice and poverty. Fetterman backs Bernie Sanders and talks about income inequality. He runs a grassroots campaign, but this week he got the endorsement of a real live elected official.
Good afternoon, everybody. Those of you who don't know me, I'm the Montgomery County Register of Wills.
Okay, it's a register of wills, but not just any register of wills. Bruce Haynes made headlines by granting marriage licenses to same-sex couples before it was authorized in Pennsylvania, and Fetterman quickly married gay and lesbian couples in Braddock, so they bonded. All these campaign events involved a few dozen voters at most. The battle that will probably decide this primary race is being waged on the airwaves.
The Philadelphia Inquirer endorses Democrat Joe SESTAC for Senate, saying he has the best credentials and experience to serve Pennsylvania and the nation.
Why have President Obama and Vice President Biden endorsed Katie McGinty for U.S. Senate?
Pennsylvania's a big state, and the best way to reach a lot of voters fast is still with expensive TV ad buys. McGinty and SESTAC will spend around $8 million between them, but McGinty, who's trailed in the polls, should have a big advertising edge in the closing week, says Franklin and Marshall analyst Terry Madonna.
It looks like she will have $3 million at least in outside money that will assist her in the campaign.
McGinty's getting $1.5 million from the National Party, which has spurned SESTAC, and a similar amount from the feminist pro-abortion rights group Emily's List. A super PAC of SESTAC's friends has spent around $700,000 on his behalf. Fetterman can't come close to their fundraising or ad buys, but he says, don't sell him short.
It's a fluid situation, and we're pursuing a different path. We're going after a different segment of the electorate. And we believe that there's still very much a path here.
Fetterman has made an impression. The Harrisburg Patriot News just endorsed him. The winner in Tuesday's primary gets to challenge Republican incumbent Pat Toomey. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Still ahead this evening, a handful of Pennsylvania towns have passed laws to prevent those with felony drug convictions from renting in their communities. And now some citizens and landlords are pushing back.
If the DOC or Department of Corrections in our judicial system believes that one of the functions and most important is to rehabilitate somebody, then part of that function is them coming out to society and being amongst us.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Criminal justice experts say ex-offenders often have a tough time finding a place to live because of their record. In a few Pennsylvania communities, it's illegal for private landlords to rent to anyone with a felony drug conviction within the past 7 years. One of them is a Cambria County borough, population 1,600. Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty reports from Gallitzin, where the ordinance is being challenged in a case that's up in court tomorrow.
Darcy Smith was arrested in 2012 in a 44-person sweep. She got out of jail in 2014 and has lived with her three kids in Gallitzin ever since, within a mile of her entire immediate family.
Right here. This is 15 minutes after I signed that lease. I get this. Telling me I gotta get out with my kids. Dear Darcy, this letter confirms your understanding today that you will vacate the premises at 306 Foster/Sugar Street as soon as possible, but absolutely within the next 2 weeks, and that you will relocate elsewhere beyond the jurisdiction of the Glitzenboro ordinance that prohibits me from knowingly renting to anyone with a past drug conviction.
The law she's talking about took effect in January 2016, banning landlords from renting to anyone with a felony drug conviction within the past 7 years. Officials wouldn't talk about why they did this, saying they were concerned about the lawsuit. The ordinance itself says the point is to try to deal with the town's drug problem. Cambria County's fatal overdose rate per capita ranked second in the most recent report on the subject from the Center for Rural Pennsylvania. The county's per capita caseload of paroled ex-drug offenders also ranked second, but it's unclear what else they've tried in Gallitzin. Statewide court records show that since 2010, just one arrest in Gallitzin has led to a felony drug conviction. Retired corrections officer Bob Bukowski lives in Gallitzin and says he doesn't agree with the law.
If the DOC or Department of Corrections and our judicial system believes that one of the functions and most important is to rehabilitate somebody, then part of that function is them coming out to society and being amongst us and being amongst their family. And if you try to separate them, where are they going to go? You might move them into a worse environment.
Experts and advocates agree these bans probably won't hold up in court. That was even before the federal government recently issued guidance warning that discriminating against ex-offenders could be illegal. Outright bans like this by a local government are unusual. Smith's lawyer, Tim Burns, says he hasn't found precedent. There was nothing the ACLU or the National Housing Law Project knew about, and we couldn't find anything either. And there haven't been challenges in Sunbury or Mifflinburg, the other Pennsylvania municipalities with similar rules. Burns describes the communities as small, blue-collar, conservative family towns.
I mean, there is a bad, we have a serious drug problem. No one will deny that. And I think they're doing what they think's best to combat it. Unfortunately, I think they're just going about it the wrong way. My client, someone is trying to rehabilitate herself, get back into society and be productive. How is that going to stop the drug problem in Gallitzin and Cambria County?
Cambria County has the highest number of supervised offenders per capita in Pennsylvania. For drug offenses, it's number two, according to a Keystone Crossroads analysis of state and census data. There aren't reliable numbers from the state on which of those drug cases are felony grade, what related recidivism rates might be, stuff like that. Gallitzin Police Chief Jerry Hagan says the drug problem in the borough and surrounding area isn't unique. But what about this weird law for landlords, which Hagan is tasked with enforcing? Is it a last resort of some kind?
Can't really comment on that.
No one would. Not the solicitor, not past or current council members who voted for the ordinance, or the mayor, and it was his idea. Councilwoman Nancy Nee said a little bit more. She talked to us at her home with her St. Bernard by her side.
I can tell you one thing. There were more positive comments on it than were negative. Many people came forward and said, good job, praised our mayor for doing it, because the people in town believed there was a need for it.
Smith's landlord, Paul Antonori, is one person who doesn't agree with the law. Antonori wrote that eviction letter we heard earlier. He says he felt like he had to. He can't pay the $1,000 a day fine, but he doesn't really support the law.
I mean, that's like a double punishment. Not only do they pay their debt to society for the conviction, which obviously they did, then now they can't live in a town? That doesn't make any sense.
Antonori is semi-retired in Florida, by the way. He doesn't live in Gallitzin. Lifelong resident Sabrina Bukowski says she wouldn't either if she could choose. She says she's sick of being confronted by the remnants of drug use.
That new playground they put over on the other side of town here, over across the bridge. Well, the first year they cleaned it up, do you know what they found? Needles. Okay, that's disgusting. What are kids wearing in the summer? Sandals, some of them no shoes.
Bukowski is a mother and pushing 40, like Darcy Smith. Smith says it's her kids keeping her in Gallitzin. She says they seem happy at school and that teachers are attentive and seem invested in their education.
I'm not going to make my kids unhappy just because these people don't want me to live here.
Smith can stay where she is for now because a Cambria County judge barred the ordinance from being enforced. The case goes to court Wednesday. Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focusing on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities and possible solutions. WHYY leads the four-station consortium. The Walnut Street Theater is producing a Broadway show that supplies the backstory to Peter Pan. But it's not the innocent little piece you might imagine. Rather, it's a pun-filled frolic called Peter and the Starcatcher that messes with the Peter Pan story to show how the Lost Boys become forever lost. Newsworks theater blogger Howard Shapiro offers this review.
You think you know somebody, and what happens? You find out he got his name from the very pirate who's out to kill him. And that pirate? You find out he got a hook on the end of his arm because he's a klutz. As we learned from the musical Wicked, everybody is likely to have a backstory. In Peter and the Starcatcher, it's the tale of three orphan boys who are forced onto a shabby ship that takes them to a faraway island, where they'll be sold to the king to use as fish bait. Well, that's a sort of crummy beginning to the J.M. Barrie story of Peter Pan, which takes up where Peter and the Starcatcher ends. Have no fear. Rick Elise's Just for Laughs play is full of shtick and surprises, and it's getting an all-out treatment at the Walnut, where the top-notch cast brings it off, stardust and all. Peter and the Starcatcher is no innocent Disney-fied look at what leads an impish boy to fly into your neighborhood and alight on your daughter's bedroom windowsill. It's a glib account, and that side of it is what entertains adults. I suspect the story and its characters attract the kids, and everyone buys into the general nonsense, which includes two identical trunks that are swapped, except that one of them has Queen Victoria's treasures inside. The race for that trunk involves the orphan boys, one of them without even a name until he runs into the pirate Blackstache, who later becomes Captain Hook. Oh, you guessed it. Here, Blackstache offers the boy a name.
Pirate Pete, that's available. Pirate Pete, good solid name is Peter, like a rock, and that's what you'd be, boy. You'd be my rock. Now, give me the trunk.
Peter, yeah, I like that.
That's the superb Ian Merrill Peaks as the pirate, and Brandon O'Rourke as Peter. O'Rourke and the other two orphans, played by Davy Raffaelli and Matthew Mastronardi, are great fun, and so is Michaela Schuckman, who plays a Wendy-like character. The show's first half is laden with too many narrated facts that are overwhelmed by general stage hubbub. That was true on Broadway as well as at the Walnut, but what follows the intermission is a rollicking and much more satisfying show. Peter and the Starcatcher runs through May 1st at Walnut Street Theater. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
Finally this evening, like all states, Delaware has an official state flower, a state tree, and a state bird. Well, now it could soon have an official canine. House members are set to vote on a bill naming the Golden Retriever Delaware's official state dog. If the measure passes and then makes its way through the state Senate and then is signed by Governor Jack Markell, Delaware would join just 12 other states that have a dog designation. And that includes Pennsylvania, which claimed the Great Dane as its official breed in 1965. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. For the first time in decades, Congressman Chaka Fateh faces a serious challenge for re-election. What's making him so vulnerable this time? Well, a criminal indictment doesn't help. More on Fateh's woes on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.